In this episode of Tuning Healthcare, I'm joined by John Gorman, Chairman of Nightingale Partners. Previously, John built Gorman Health Group and was the first assistant to the Director of Healthcare Financing Administration, the precursor to CMS. John has a fascinating perspective on the role of government versus the role of the private sector. We discuss how not enough respect and value is given to the caregivers in America, how Maslow's hierarchy and the need to address the most basic needs of the human population must be addressed by healthcare organizations. He gives us his unfettered view on Trump and the role that Joe Biden needs to play in evolving the healthcare system, including his views on Medicare for All. It's a fascinating episode. Join John and I as we tune healthcare. John, thanks for joining me today. Great to have you on.
Great pleasure, Nigel. Thanks. Great to see you again.
You know, you hold a special place in the Lumeris history, right? We presented at the Gorman Healthcare Conference, and as a result of that, I think got our second client, Network Health Plan, up in Wisconsin.
The Fox Valley of Wisconsin, yeah.
Yeah, so I spent a lot of time in Appleton, Wisconsin. And so you've obviously seen Lumeris since pretty much the beginning, and we
there
appreciate
at the birth. Yes.
We appreciate the friendship that you've shown us over the years. So anyway, but thank you for joining. What I'd love to start with, you obviously have such a storied history in healthcare, right? With the government role, in the private sector. Give us a little bit of background. How did you start? How did you get into healthcare? Take us through the highlights of the John Gorman story.
Well, I like to think I've got the scars on the ass of a man twice my age, but 30 years here in DC is a long tenure. I came to DC straight out of college. I was hired by my hometown congressman from Detroit, John Conyers Jr., to come and be his press secretary. A year later, I was his chief of staff. And he walked into my office in 1990 and said that he wanted to lead the Congressional Black Caucus on healthcare reform, and that he wanted to help line up the CBC behind Jim McDermott's single payer bill. And he wanted to have a bill of his own. And I said, that's all wonderful. And I think that's great. And he says, great, because you're going to do it. And I was like, but Congressman, I don't know anything about healthcare. And he turned around and he said, now, Johnny, you know, that's bullshit. He's like, you were raised in a household of full of doctors. And my mother's a doctor. My dad's a doctor. My brother, my aunt, my uncle, my stepmother, my little brother, my little sister. He's like, you probably have forgotten more about healthcare from 18 years of kitchen table conversation than the rest of us are going to learn for the rest of our career. So you're doing healthcare. And that was that. So had the great pleasure of working with the Single Payer Coalition way back when, and putting the bill together, doing all the investigations up in Canada and England of the NHS and what single payer systems that were functioning looked like. It was pretty exciting. A year later, I was helping run President Clinton's campaign in Michigan in 92. And when he won was when I got appointed to what was then, Nigel, you'll remember, the Healthcare Financing Administration, or HCFA, which is now CMS, of course. So we were tasked with opening the first office of managed care. So we had operational authority over all the Medicare and Medicaid managed care programs, really at the period of their greatest growth in the early 90s. And I was there for 3 years as the number two guy in the office. And that was a really formative experience for me. And I think I got known as a no kind of guy who got stuff done. And from there, I opened Gorman Health Group, which led to the relationship with Lumeris. And, you know, I ran GHG for 22 years before I just decided to sell the company in 2018 and retire. And then my wife came in one morning after I'd been laying about for months saying, you got to go do something because you got to get out of the house. And that's when Nightingale Partners, our current company, was born. And then the pandemic hit, so I ended up being home anyway. So here we are. Yeah. Long and storied history.
Yeah, and before we started, you mentioned that you know, your mother lives in Maine, and unfortunately she took a fall. Give us a little bit of and had COVID.
COVID, yeah.
Wow. So give us a little bit of a perspective of from sort of the personal side, you know, dealing with the pandemic. You mentioned your home, obviously you had to deal with your mother. Your mother, yeah. I'm assuming, as you said, had COVID. She's, I'm assuming, elderly. You know, tell us a little bit from the personal side how this has impacted you, your family.
I mean, I think an experience like this is eye-opening in terms of the incredible value, not just personally with a patient, but the value to the economy that caregivers represent in this country. I mean, caregiving, especially a sick elderly parent, is a full-time job plus. And we don't ascribe nearly as much value to that role in this country as we should, considering the incredible gray tsunami that's sweeping this country right now. We've got to get a lot more proactive about what the needs of caregivers and a growing elderly population in this country really means in terms of how we support them all. I was stuck up there for over a month, Nigel, if for no other reason than I couldn't find a single home healthcare aide or a home health nurse practitioner in the entire state of Maine until September. So I ended up sleeping on her couch for 5 weeks with her cats, trying to care for her because I had no other options. And I'm a, you know, an affluent guy that could have paid out of pocket had the help been available, but it was not. So her whole village that ended up tasked with her aftercare was this patchwork quilt of friends, family, the occasional physical therapist and occupational therapist, and then just, you know, arranging all the follow-up appointments and everything else. We do not nearly ascribe enough value to the role of caregivers, and we've got to get a whole lot more sophisticated about how we support them and the patients they're caring for, if we want to have any hope of dealing with the graying of America. It was my big takeaway.
So how do we give more respect and value to the caregiver?
Well, I think one way would be to really think about a dramatic modernization of the Family and Medical Leave Act. I mean, we're obviously doing a horrible job of supporting people, especially caregivers during this pandemic. I mean, the fact that, you know, most of these poor folks have seen a $1,200 check 5 months ago, and we're about to see, you know, eviction bans and everything else expire. I mean, I would start there. Anytime you're talking about a social intervention, like a caregiver caring for an octogenarian, you know, I'm always drawn back to the foundation of social health care, which is Maslow's hierarchy, right? And Maslow always posited that, you know, when you think of a hierarchy of human needs, at the bottom of that hierarchy, the most important, of course, are food, shelter, and safety. And if you've got millions of caregivers who are, you know, often, very often lower income people, whether they're home health aides or whether they're family members, you know, we've got to do a better job of just supporting people through this pandemic. I mean, this has just been an absolute clown show from the federal government by any measure. And, you know, I think when you've got people, especially caregivers, millions of them worried about whether or not they're going to be able to make the rent this month because they haven't gotten help from the government in almost half a year in the middle of this thing. You know, when people are struggling to make ends meet, they don't know where or how they're going to feed their family after, you know, their check runs out or unemployment benefits run out at the end of the month. Those are not folks who are going to be capable and present caregivers to the folks that they're minding. So I think the first thing that we've got to do is to really take care of the basic human needs of caregivers, starting with, you know, all of the theories in Maslow's hierarchy that we first have to worry about their shelter, their food, their safety. And then from there, just doing a better job of, you know, stuff like where are we with universal childcare and things that, you know, every other industrialized country has that enables people to do this job. You know, the ability to drop your kids off at a childcare so that you can go care for mom for the day would be hugely helpful. I think we're also right on the verge, Nigel, of a real revolution in home and community-based services and alternatives to congregate care settings for the elderly. I mean, I think this pandemic has laid bare the tremendous exposure of congregate care facilities like nursing homes to, you know, extreme outbreaks of this virus. Nursing homes were one of the rare products in American life that nobody wanted and nobody, and insurance companies certainly didn't want to have to pay for. And the pandemic, I think, has heaped on the nursing home industry that just nobody wants to be there. And that we could much safely and more efficiently and really more in line with patient needs care for a great many people at home and in community-based settings. So I think we're really on the verge, as we're seeing really right now in telehealth, Nigel, you know, a much greater emphasis and a revolution in home care, in community-based services. I think we're about to see an explosion in the program of all-inclusive care for the elderly, or PACE. You know, this is basically a 40-year experiment the government's been doing with adult daycare centers on steroids. And, you know, those programs are wildly popular with seniors who are SNF eligible and their caregivers. And they offer them an adult daycare center to go to during the day and all kinds of wraparound services in the community and at home. And I think we're going to just see a lot more of that because we are just not at all equipped at the moment for caring for millions of frail elders at home during a pandemic. Does that make sense?
John, you hit on a number of fascinating topics there. One in particular that I've spent a lot of time looking at and would love your perspective given your background. What's the role of the government versus the private sector in trying to fix some of the problems we have in healthcare? So you've just touched on one, right? We don't give enough respect and value to the caregiver. And within that one topic, you know, you probably touched on like 10 others as well. As you think about healthcare, I mean, there's such a myriad of problems that we have. What I liked about one of the things you said, right, was rather than trying to fix everything, you honed in on healthcare for children, right? As opposed to saying, I'm going to try and fix everything. But just start with the first question I asked, which is government versus the private sector. How do we, who should be responsible for what in trying to make the healthcare system better?
Well, I mean, clearly I think that's a role for the federal government. Now, I'm a raging loony left-wing Democrat. So, you know, of course I believe in the power of government to right societal ills and to do so in a way that's far more consistent than leaving it to a patchwork quilt of 50 states and all the politics that reside therein. So, you know, on issues of national import, like, are we going to cover all of our children? Or are we going to provide health insurance for all of our elders? Are we going to provide a universal basic income to seniors through Social Security so that they're not starving in their elderly years? Those are all absolutely questions in the domain of the federal government to address. And because of the push-pull of politics in this country and, you know, Republicans screaming for the last 60 years, keep the government out of my Medicare, or whatever the hell that means, you know, we've developed, you know, this very messy hybrid patchwork quilt of coverage in this country where we have universal coverage of the elderly through a single payer in Medicare that over 38% of them, approaching 40%, have chosen a private sector option called Medicare Advantage. Then we attempted to do universal coverage of kids and low-income families and single adults through the establishment of Medicaid, then the establishment of the CHIP program under President Clinton, and then the establishment of the Medicaid expansion and the exchanges and the subsidies in Obamacare. And that was only a partial success, and that we still have largely an employer-based insurance system in this country, Nigel, that, as you know, about 75 million Americans are covered through their employer. And I think right now through this pandemic with, you know, 40 million people unemployed, we're really beginning to see the limits of that system because, you know, we're seeing now millions of people losing their employer-based health insurance and then having to fall back into this patchwork quilt of the exchanges or Medicaid or Medicare to meet the need. So, you know, very rightly during the Democratic primaries, you saw a lot of emphasis around a Medicare for all. I think a proposal like that is doomed to fail. Getting everybody in this country, the 40 million plus who are uninsured, into a fee-for-service based entitlement program would just set us back 40 years from all the advances that have been made in care coordination and value-based payment and accountable care. I think if we're going to really make a go at universal coverage in a Biden administration, then I think the form that that would take is kind of like what Pete Buttigieg and Kamala Harris were talking about during the primaries, and that would be a Medicare Advantage for all who want it. You know, we certainly saw in Hillary Care and in the heated debate over Obamacare that, you know, those 75 million people with employer-based insurance, they like it. They don't want anybody messing with it. We should let them keep it. Okay. But anybody else, the 40 plus million who are uninsured, you know, a Medicare Advantage for all who want it would be a uniquely American take on single payer. You would still have the single payer that is Medicare, but then it's privately administered through a network of hundreds of health plans under contract with that government. And if we regulate the hell out of those plans, as we've seen in Democratic administrations, you can achieve an incredible public good within a system of care like that. And, you know, just being a guy who in 30 years in Washington, I've learned to just go as far left as you can and still win. I think that's actually what could win in a Biden administration, which we all, at least in my household, are praying comes next.
So Medicare Advantage for all, I agree with you, right? If you compare the performance of Medicare fee-for-service to Medicare Advantage, it's night and day. And as you say, the advancements made by that. And I like the way you frame it, of a uniquely American way of taking something that is sort of regulated by the government, but in effect run by private industry to drive those improvements, the efficiencies, the innovation and everything else that does sure. that. So I think that's
As opposed to a big Medicaid expansion. You know, right. we've seen the shortcomings of that, Nigel, in Obamacare with, you know, all the red states that refused the greatest deal offered them since Reconstruction. The government's going to pay the entire freight for this expansion for the first 10 years and then an enhanced rate thereafter. I mean, all these red states that declined to take the Medicaid expansion did so just despite a black president and sacrificed the health of their populations. By the way, they were paying for that expansion in blue states anyway through the tax system. So that's really the reason why I don't think a state-administered program like Medicaid is the answer to uninsurance in this country, but rather it has to be a federal response through a federal program like Medicare Advantage or through the Obamacare exchanges.
So the Democrats just put out their platform, right? Their manifesto for 2020. Yep. Go far enough for you in healthcare?
Like I said, man, go as far as to the left as you can and still win.
Right. What would you like to see Biden do between now and November?
Well, what I'd love to see Joe do is entirely separate from what might be possible. And that question all revolves around whether or not the Democrats get the Senate back. Now, that is certainly within reach right now, but you are never going to get to anything approaching universal coverage as long as Mitch McConnell is running the United States Senate. So if the Dems make a complete sweep in these elections in November, as is looking like they could, I mean, Biden is way up over Trump, as you're seeing, and all of the swing state races to control the Senate are all, you know, swinging Democratic right now. Then if the Dems reclaim the Senate, then you have a lot more that's possible than if Mitch McConnell's still running the place.
So as Winston Churchill famously said, right, a week is a long time in politics. Yeah. And, you know, you could have a scenario in November where coronavirus is finally decreasing.
Raging.
Right, you could have a decreasing. Nah. Well, you could, potentially, right?
You could, but it won't.
Right,
yeah.
And potentially the economy. So do you think he can just basically stay relatively quiet and let Trump implode all that? And
that's what he's been doing. Yeah. And
do you think are you saying that strategy is enough from your perspective?
Well, for now it is. It's like right. Napoleon said, it's like when the enemy's killing himself, don't interrupt.
Right.
You know, so that's what Joe's been doing. He's been running a quiet campaign out of his basement. He's outraising Trump every step of the way. He's 11 to 13 points ahead of the guy in every poll that's being held right now. I mean, he's crushing this guy right now by doing very little, running a nice quiet campaign, being the calmness that I think a majority of Americans are craving after these 4 years of chaos.
Right.
So, you know, he doesn't have to do anything different right now until the convention. I think everybody's waiting with great anticipation for who his VP pick is going to be.
Who's your pick? Who would you pick? He said, if he could, called you up and said, John, who should I pick?
I tell you, man, I am far more interested in who he's going to appoint as Attorney General and who he's going to appoint as Secretary of the Treasury than I am about who's going to be the Vice President. I mean, I know Joe Biden quite well, and his granddaughter goes to school with mine and plays lacrosse with her, and we see Joe frequently. He is as sharp as any octogenarian I have ever seen. I don't worry about this guy's longevity in office at all. I mean, I just can't wait for these debates. So, you know, maybe one of these questioners will put the dementia test to both of them and they see how they do comparatively in a live setting. That I just cannot wait for. But I don't worry about who he's going to pick for VP so much because of his age. I mean, I think we've seen lots and lots of seniors do incredible things at Joe's age, and I don't think he's going to be any different. I really do want to see a crusader at the Justice Department, like Kamala Harris, who's been a prosecutor, and, you know, she knows what's going to need to happen to rebuild our nation of laws after this, you know, utterly corrupt administration. I am dying to see Elizabeth Warren at Treasury, because I think she's just going to put Wall Street in a fit of panic. And she's going to bring a degree of accountability to that agency and the sprawling empire that Treasury controls, especially around, you know, figuring out where did all this stimulus money go. There's been zero accountability for how that money's been spent. And I'm far more worried about those two agencies in particular than I am about the VP pick.
Who'd you like to see at HHS?
Obviously my friend, mentor, inspiration, Andy Slavitt, would be, I think, an incredible HHS administrator.
Right.
And I think would restore a lot of confidence in the agency after the lapdog that Alex Azar has become. And I think would bring an adherence to science and evidence back to the sprawling empire that is the Department of Health and Human Services as well. And that's largely been rendered, you know, another political, politicized agency under the Trump administration. Now for VP, you know, Joe said that it's going to be a woman. And I love him for that. And I know he's going to do. The question is it going to be a woman of color, to my mind? I love the idea of a Stacey Abrams. I love the idea of Representative Bass or Val Demings from Florida. I mean, there's just any number of qualified women of color that would be amazing VPs and that I would be very comfortable with a heartbeat away from the presidency. But like I said, I'm not as troubled about, or, you know, concerned about that appointment as I am about who's going to restore our nation of laws.
So if you were a health system right now, let's say you were tapped and they said, hey, John, come run ABC Health System. Obviously, you had to shut down elective procedures during during the coronavirus. You're losing money, razor thin margins, being attacked on all sides by payers, primary care aggregators. What would your strategy be? What would you do if you were running a health system now? Now that, you know, obviously, we could go into so many nuances of rural versus city competition or so, but. But broadly speaking, as you think about health systems, where would you set the strategy? What would your advice be?
I mean, first and foremost, I have always said that, you know, the worst job I could imagine right now would be to be the administrator of a small community hospital. Man, is that a tough job in this environment. If I was running a health system, of course, it would depend on geography and sophistication and everything else. But I think the strategy that's been illuminated, especially during this pandemic, Nigel, has got to be you got to get on a path to value-based care. I mean, you've got to be accepting risk and you've got to be capitated, because to continue to try to operate in a fee-for-service environment when elective procedures are all shut down and you know, you're just living on the whims of infection rates right now. Getting paid fee for service is what kills you in a pandemic. And this isn't going to be the last one of these that we have. In fact, it's possible and even likely that another one will break while we're still dealing with this one. So, you know, I think against that backdrop and where payers are certainly marching in formation too, is toward value-based care, toward more accountable care, toward really delivering on very specific performance metrics that are moving from process measures much more oriented toward outcomes. And I think, as we've seen in every survey shown of health systems in this last 2 years, Nigel, they all agree that one of the absolute top strategic priorities has to be mastering social determinants of health. And I think the last survey that I saw when I was doing work over at Premier, the big hospital purchasing cooperative, as a Medicare Advantage advisor to them, was that upwards of 90% of health systems said, we have to master social determinants if we're going to have a long-term future as a health system.
So lots in there. Let's hit social determinants of health first.
Sure.
John Gorman once famously said, social determinants of health are just four fancy words for poverty.
Sure.
Tell us what you mean by that, and how does that then play into the health system strategy?
Sure. Well, we know social determinants, and you know, I think saying that's just four fancy words for poverty really does simplify it for everybody, because that's what it is.
Right.
Social determinants are the circumstances in which people live, who they live with, what they eat, what they drink, what they breathe. What are the long-term effects of systemic racism, of nonstop police oppression, as we're seeing in the streets right now? All of those things inform strategies, and they are all responsible for 60 to 80% of what we spend on healthcare in this country, Nigel. And I think one of the great reasons why, you know, the disease management fad collapsed and burned in the 90s was, you know, I think we know now you can't just manage diseases in isolation. You have to manage a whole patient holistically in order to have any hope of addressing an underlying disease or comorbidities. Again, we get back to Maslow's hierarchy, right? That says if you're not meeting people's basic human needs, food, shelter, safety, then you can't reasonably expect them to be a compliant or engaged patient. You know, Mrs. Ramirez with uncontrolled diabetes and two other comorbidities, who is housing insecure and food insecure, she's thinking about where her next bed and her next meal is coming from. She's not thinking about, did I take my insulin right today? Have I taken my insulin right for the last 30 consecutive days so that I avoid being the million-dollar baby to the health plan I'm enrolled in? I mean, what really tipped me into wanting to do this and to dedicate the remainder of my career, Nigel, to addressing social determinants and helping the insurance industry and big health systems invest in social determinant interventions was the landmark study out of Geisinger a couple of years ago, you know, the huge rural system in central Pennsylvania. Geisinger found that it was spending about $300,000 per patient per year, Nigel, on their uncontrolled elderly diabetics. So they started a medically appropriate meal delivery service for about 1,000 of them. And within 14 months, they had reduced the average cost to $48,000 per patient per year. So net of the cost of the meal preparation, packaging, delivery, and all the wraparound services that went into it, Geisinger saved $192,000 per patient per year just by feeding people, just by dealing with Maslow's hierarchy. And that, I think, is an object study for all of us, whether you're in finance, whether you're in health systems, whether you're in direct care management. That was a 35x ROI. I mean, where else in this world, Nigel, do you see a 35% or 35x return on investment, but in dealing with the effects of poverty and the concurrent savings that we can achieve by investing in anti-poverty initiatives, like a meal delivery program for diabetics, or a transportation program for homebound elders so that they can get to doctor's appointments instead of to the ER in an ambulance, like doing a peer-based prenatal counseling program for at-risk African-American women, like deploying an army of community health workers to help really complex patients better navigate the health system and to help them enroll in all the other social welfare programs that they may be eligible for. All of those interventions that I just mentioned, Nigel, have been shown in study after study to save at least $2,500 per member per year when you deploy them. And all of those measures taken together reliably result in a 3 to 8x ROI. And in Geisinger's case, sometimes as much as 35x. For an investor like me, those are investable events. Those are beautiful projects to structure. And since we opened our doors in January, we've yet to produce an investor prospectus that had less than a 30% internal rate of return, because you can just save so much money just by meeting basic human needs in the healthcare system. So that's why I think, you know, frankly, health system executives have grasped onto social determinants as the path forward on bending the cost curve far sooner than their colleagues in the health insurance industry, because health and health system execs are far closer to the patients and they see these effects in daily life far more than a CEO of an insurance company does.
Right. So one of the things that's great to see, John, is that the Opportunity Zone program, right? That isn't that a Republican policy, Medicare Advantage, another one that I think came out of a Republic. It's great that there's room for bipartisan opportunity, even from the great John Gorman.
Well, I mean, I'm not immune to opportunism when we can help a great number of people. And the Opportunity Zone program, you know, I initially blew it off, Nigel. I was chasing for a better part of a year when I was retired. I was chasing social impact bonds as a potential source of financing social determinant interventions in our industry. And I just found that all these guys doing social impact bonds, it was largely just a big carriage of bull. A lot of it was greenwashing, you know, just investments they would have made otherwise in private equity or venture capital. And to the extent that they were health related, you know, it was stuff like digging wells in Africa or, you know, doing better access to retroviral cocktails for folks with AIDS in the third world. We wanted to really ensure that all of this money was being invested domestically. And I blew off Opportunity Zones precisely because it came out of Trump's big tax giveaway bill. And then last April, Nigel, the IRS, in a shocker, revised the regs to make them a lot simpler. So originally this was conceived, and by the way, this was Senator Cory Booker's program and designed, you know, with his home city of Newark in mind. It was originally designed to be a real estate revitalization program in economically disadvantaged areas. And like I said, last April, the IRS pulled a shocker and loosened the regulation. So now it wasn't just real estate purchases, but now you could use Opportunity Zone capital for leases, but more importantly, Nigel, for working capital and for meeting the business requirements of a new co in one of the 9,000 Opportunity Zones that they designated nationally. So all of those Opportunity Zones are economically disadvantaged and medically underserved. And that revision of the regs, which were then codified in December and why we opened our doors in January, was now we can use Opportunity Zone capital for big, large-scale investments in social determinants with health insurers and with health systems. And in some cases, we're doing it with some state and local governments as well. And as long as we base that venture in one of the Opportunity Zones there that's in their coverage area, we're golden in terms of the use of funds. Right. So it's proving to be a wonderful program, and we like to say that we hacked a Republican billionaire tax shelter to try to improve healthcare for Black and Brown people.
It actually, so obviously we obviously wish you great success with that. It's an important mission, but actually warms my heart that there's an opportunity to make the world a better place by pooling some of the best ideas, right, irrespective of where they come from.
Sure.
You know, we live right now in a world that is so partisan. There's no room for nuanced debate or discussion, right, on any topic, right? We know the reality of it is that it's so nuanced, right? And in order to be successful, you have to be able to appreciate and understand those nuances. And so the ability that to take ideas, opportunities that come, and use them to drive better healthcare is excellent. I like to end, John, with what we call the quick fire round. Just a couple of questions.
Oh, Jesus.
Get your off the cuff, easy questions. Best piece of business
advice.
Could have
used a shot of tequila for this, but go ahead.
Go for it. Go get one quickly. What best piece of business advice?
Be acutely honest with yourself about not just what you're good at, but more importantly, what you're not good at, and surround yourself with people that are good at those things. That's been the key to the success of every business I've ever launched and sold. I know what I like to do. I know what I'm good at. And I'm very honest with myself about what I suck at. And those are the people that I go out and look to surround myself with. And that's been by far some of the best advice I've ever gotten.
That's great advice. Thing you like to do for fun when you're not building Nightingale?
I'm a very proud doggo daddy. But probably the craziest thing that I do for fun is twice a year we go on a very storied annual boar hunt in Texas, and we even ran the quarantine to go on our spring hunt in Texas this year, Nigel. So I've been going to this ranch in Texas for the last 15 years, and I tell you, my friend, if you have never been out with a gang of dudes out in the wilderness hunting dangerous animals that are trying to kill you too, and the camaraderie and all the insanity that goes with an outing like that, man, it's about as much fun as you can have with your clothes on. And I'm a very rare, liberal, heavily armed gun nut. I would gladly give up my arsenal to stop the carnage on the streets, but while we can have them, I love killing pigs with my AK.
and then finally, on healthcare, if there was one thing that you could change to improve our healthcare system, what would it be?
Well, I mean, you got to say universal coverage. I mean, as much as we're committed to social determinant interventions, a lot of the projects we look for are how can we expand coverage? Because, you know, it's one thing to give people access to services that they need, but to give them coverage gives them financial security and access to providers that many of these folks who have been uninsured, especially the chronically uninsured, access to services that they've never had. And I think that's just crucially important. You know, one of the most favorite periods of my career, Nigel, was serving as the lobbyist for the community health centers and during the Hillary Care debate. And, you know, Republicans love to use the community health center program as a fig leaf by saying that if we have universal primary care, then what do we need health insurance for? And I just think that's just such a argument. Coverage is what really grants people access to a great many more providers than just the amazing federally qualified health centers across the country. So I think we really do need to start there.
Great. John, thank you for joining us today. Thanks for taking the time. We wish you well. Wish your mom
always
should
a pleasure,
be well.
Roger.
And look
so
forward
much.
To connecting again soon. Thank
All right,
you.
Brother. We'll see you again soon. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us today. Please follow us on your favorite streamer and don't forget to rate us, as it helps others find this podcast. I hope you stay safe and healthy at this difficult time, and please join us next time as we tune healthcare. This is Nigel Orenstein in New York.